All right, clear out your throats, you phlegm, refill your drinks.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Discovering Darwin, a semi-regular, intermittent, drifting along podcast that is dedicated to the writings and musings of Charles Darwin. My name is James Wagner. I'm a biology professor at Transylvania University, and I am joined by my two bourbon-infused colleagues.
That's right.
Getting there.
Dr. Sarah Bray.
Hi, James.
Hello. She's a professor of biology at Transylvania University, and Mark Jackson.
That's me.
Yeah. Professor of psychology.
Correct.
At the same university.
Yes.
we all get together and talk about Darwin, but Sarah, as you might remember this season, has encouraged us to read a totally different book, Bitch on the Female of the Species by Lucy Cook, a wonderful read that works to sort of realign our understanding of sexual selection in a more modern view. And this is the last episode of this season. We hope to have a ultimate episode with Lucy Cook. She's agreed to talk to us. We have to coordinate ourselves. It's spring break right now.
Across the pond.
Yeah. We're going to, I think, try to do it during finals week is what I'm thinking, because that's, Mark and I, for some reason, have a class schedule that's exactly opposite of each other, so we can never combine.
You compliment me, Jim.
Yes, there you go.
Your greatness cannot be in the same time slot, right? The students would riot. There would just be problems.
That's right. Competitive exclusion.
Yes.
I don't want to compete against Mark. But anyway, so we're today going to talk about the last chapter, chapter 11, and her conclusion chapter. This book, as I said, has done a wonderful job of sort of telling the stories of female scientists who have done historically great work trying to realign our understanding of sexual selection. And this last chapter, chapter 11, called Beyond the Binary, Evolution's Rainbow, I think is one of the strongest chapters. What do you guys think? Because it has very small but very powerful stories about the non-binary element of sexual identity in animals. And I was wondering, Sarah, what do you think about the whole barnacle story with Chuck?
Yeah. So, and I think we've joked on this podcast because we always are like, oh, what's the next season going to be? And we're like, hey, let's do the, how many volumes is it on barnacles?
Four.
Yeah. I want to do the worms.
Yeah. So, Darwin was pretty obsessed with barnacles, so much so that, in fact, one of the time, and Lucy Cook quotes this, that one of his kids went over to play at a friend's house and was like, so where does your dad do barnacles? Because that's what normal dads do. Right?
And he would get barnacles mailed to him.
Yeah.
Like they would box them up and put them in, you know, alcohol and ship them to him. And he would dissect them in his study. Like for years.
Like someone's cleaning the hull of a ship and yeah, says, you know, like, what this makes me think
off.
Of? Charles.
Chuck.
Darwin.
Chuck would like
these. Let's save a few of these.
So yeah, you're probably all familiar with barnacles as those things that are stuck to ships, right?
And whales.
That need to be, scraped off. And whales will scrape themselves on things to get them off. And sailors have to scrape them off ships to get them off. So they're sedentary, which leads to some challenges for sexy times, right? In that
not only are they solitary, I mean, what'd you say?
Sessile.
Sessile. They're like
Cemented.
Yeah. Cemented.
Permanently there, right?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. And so many species, I'm not sure if it's all, but many species are hermaphroditic. So maybe we need to talk about that first.
Hermes and Aphrodite.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what does that mean?
I think it means that you got both naughty bits, right? You can do both the male stuff and the female stuff.
Right.
And then there's the question of whether you can do it to yourself.
Ah, yes.
Right.
Yes.
Whether you have to be paired up with somebody else and you guys swap, like earthworms. They do that. They kind of pair up and then swap.
Right.
Swap sperm.
Yeah. And so a lot of diversity within hermaphrodites, too, because sometimes you hear serial hermaphrodites, you might be hermaphroditic, so producing both at the same time. You might be seasonally producing the different gametes. But anyway, so I think what makes particularly barnacles famous, and maybe I'll just read a part of this because it's great language from both Darwin and Lucy Cook, says, Darwin discovered the barnacle's secret weapon is an extravagant penis, the longest relative to body size in the animal kingdom. Darwin's customary functional prose takes an almost giddy turn as he describes how the barnacle's probosciform penis is wonderfully developed and lies coiled up like a great worm. But when fully extended, it must equal 8 and 9 times the entire length of the animal. So I also enjoy this, and it's becoming more and more awkward actually as we go through time. So Isabella Rossellini created this web series. I think it actually started on Sundance Channel, but now you can find it online, that she calls Green Porno. Mm-hmm. And it's all about the sex lives and animals. And she like has like, they will create sets and costumes for her. And so in one of them, she's the barnacle. And like, she's like reeling out this penis, right? And it's going and gets into this mountain of another barnacle next door. And I showed it to my intro class this semester, who have no idea who Isabella Rossellini is anyway. I gave them zero context, because all it was we were talking about the Pizaster story and the barnacles in there. That was it. So like, they were like, this is,
Sarah,
I'm like, this is
whenever you can bring sex into a story.
I do.
Because that story is all about
competition and predation. Yeah, but I'm just
community structure.
Let's talk about barnacle sex. And I throw this up, and it was just like, I swear it was 30 seconds of them just like staring at me afterwards. So anyway, barnacles.
And they're crustaceans, right?
Yeah.
They're related to crabs and lobsters and those sorts of things. And they're weird. They're sort of upside down, and they create this little castle of calcium carbonate around them, and they sort of encase themselves against predation.
And they live with their heads attached, right?
To whatever
that is.
So they live upside down.
Yeah. And there's different species, right? So in this case, right, this is one with the biggest penis to body size we know of, and like literally just sneaks around. And videos of like Lily of this art, she talks about it. What does she say? An X-rated Mr. Tickle, it does, right? It's this little thing out there. Anyway, so that's one strategy. Another strategy is that when you have separate sexes, that the male will actually deposit into the female, essentially like go down inside her little castle, right?
Yeah, so he becomes the sort of free living small thing.
Yeah, just kind of denigrates?
Degenerates,
there we go, into basically just
gonads.
Some testes, right?
Right. And that Darwin saw that was sort of this intermediate stage between having separate sexes and then having all the material in one.
Right. And that the degenerate form, it took him a while to figure out, right? Isn't that the story of him like picking these things off and throwing them away?
He thought they were mites or some sort of parasite.
And then realizing, oh, that's a whole bunch of males.
Yeah, he called them complemental males.
Yeah.
I think Lucy Cook made me realize something very interesting, right? She talks about Darwin and his barnacles, which I was familiar with, but she points out that he never talks about this in Descent of Man.
Yeah. Right.
And what do you guys think about that? Like, why do you think he avoided it? Was it because it was just too messy?
I just assume for Darwin that was way too messy, right? Mm-hmm. He's trying to tell this really clear story of competitive dominant males and coy
submissive females.
Yeah, right. And if they're in between, what do you do with that?
Yeah.
You know, especially a this male that has degenerated to just testes, right? Mm-hmm. That is definitely not the bigger picture of what he was saying.
Yeah. So so we have this really weird animal that sort of has both male and female body parts, but also has some species that show the divergence in sexes, right? Mm-hmm. And then she also points out another, the sea anemone fish, the Finding Nemo.
Clownfish,
right.
That's what I thought that was.
Yeah. Mark, do you remember that story and how that kind of fits with this idea of not non-binary sex determination?
To a degree, right? This was the one in particular that was protoandrous?
That's correct.
Right? So, again...
First male.
Right. So, yeah, she's documented, and we've talked several times about a whole chapter, right, devoted to certain species that switch, right? Mm-hmm. But this is one that is not completely unique, but rare in the sense that it starts off male and then has the potential to switch to female. And it does so given circumstances, right? Environmental pressures, like not enough of...
Females,
right. Yeah, exactly.
Because they live in a sea anemone, which itself is a predatory cnidarian. So,
and they all have like mucus on them, so they're not getting stung by the cnidarian.
So they kind of hide into this anemone and use it as a place to avoid getting eaten.
Right. And there's within the groups, it's a dominant female, right? And then the males that are supportive or whatever.
Yeah. So that's go ahead.
Yeah. And of course, she draws the analogy. This is brilliant, that if you want to retell the story of Finding Nemo, accurately, you got to change some things that might make some kids uncomfortable. Right?
So, or their parents.
Right. Yeah, because the premise of the movie is that Nemo's mother is snatched away by Barracuda, and so then starts this journey to find mom, right?
No, find dad.
Find mom.
Wait.
With dad.
Dad is finding Nemo, the kid.
Wait, who got snatched by the Barracuda?
The mom. But then Nemo is like, I'm going to go find my mama.
Oh.
And then the dad has to go find the kid.
Nemo.
Oh, right. Gotcha.
The kid is Nemo.
Right. But in reality, if that were to happen...
Dad would have become mom.
Dad becomes mom and starts having sex with Nemo.
Okay. So, maybe we should have given you more context. Gave you a new Disney movie.
Yeah.
So, in the anemone, as you said, Mark, there's a group of fish. Mm-hmm. Like, if you were snorkeling there and you saw them, there'd be like four fish.
Right.
There'd be a large clownfish, and that's the female. Then there's the next large clownfish, that's the dominant male.
Right.
And then there's a couple of submissive males that are not mating.
Right.
They're just in queue.
Right.
And the idea is that, well, then why does the other male put up with it? Well, the thought is for him to take energy and chase them away. It's not benefit him any, right? Mm-hmm. So he just ends up tolerating these submissive males who are in queue waiting for the dominant female to disappear so that the dominant male becomes the dominant female.
Right.
And then they become...
They step up.
They step up. Yeah. Now, the thing that I thought was most interesting about that story was that she points out that, you know, there's a preoptic part of the brain that is associated with a lot of hormonal changes, and often for females it's more developed than in males.
Right.
It made some sort of statement about that being sort of coordinating ovulation and coordinating all the complexity of eggs and egg laying. And she says that when these males do that transition to females, so the optical part of the preoptic cortex starts to develop.
Right.
The fish starts acting like a female.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, that I found particularly fascinating too. Is it so... And I think her point is to, again, challenge that sex is tied to
gonads,
right? Because in that transition process, so before the clownfish has developed female gonads, the others treat it as female.
Right.
I mean, it responds to others as female. So basically, it's situating, in this case, sex in behaviors as opposed to... which again follows from, because of course the first part that starts to transition is the brain, right? Mm-hmm. Which then motivates the other behaviors. But in situations where you, because apparently females will fight each other, right?
Right.
Males are submissive to any female. And so you put a quickly or recently starting to transition now female in with another clearly established female, and they'll fight.
Like, right. Step off.
Yeah.
But the transition female still has male testes still making male hormones, testosterone.
Right.
And still, so if you were doing the anatomy definition, it would be a male. If you're doing the hormonal definition, it'd be a male.
Right.
But if you did the behavioral definition, it's clearly a female.
And for me in particular, more than just sort of that individual fish's behaviors, but the behavioral responses of the other fish. Mm-hmm.
Right. So they recognize
it.
Yeah.
Right. And treat this organism as
the
goal. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
That it's headed towards.
So what do we have here? We have a conversation where we're talking both about physical characteristics of sex, right? And you know, popular culture right now, there's many very simplistic minded individuals who say XY, XX, that's who you are. You know, don't confuse sex and gender.
Small gametes, large gametes.
Mm-hmm. Right. But this argument to me is very intriguing because she does clearly make the argument that your, and this, we haven't really untied these two, sex and gender, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But your identity, how about that? Your identity starts in the brain, not in the gonads.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we should talk for a second again. We've done it before, but maybe return to it here because it kind of swirls around sex and gender. Mark, do you want to sort of tell us how you teach those differences? I mean, obviously gender is a social construct, right?
It is, yes, absolutely. And the way that it's, and this book challenges sort of how I might start teaching this in the future. But the standard party line is sex is what you're assigned at birth. It's tied to biology. Gender is the social construct. It's the lived experience, the identification, right? And that these are And for most folks, everything lines up nicely and life is easy or easier, right? But when they don't, then we start looking at issues of transgender and thinking about, again, those instances where they don't line up. But they are conceptually construed as different and potentially independent, not necessarily entirely orthogonal, but because most times it lines up, but that these are not the same thing. But if we're defining sex as behavior patterns,
right?
Now we're actually, that crosses the line in the way that it's typically taught into what is considered gender, right? So these are roles that we perform as opposed to something grounded in chromosomes or gametes or something like that.
Yeah, so like in the text, like she's interviewing Joan Roughgarden. We've talked about Joan Roughgarden earlier in the podcast, but Roughgarden defines gender specifically in non-human animals, and we can return to that too, as the appearance, behavior, and life history of a sexed body. What do you think of that?
I'm not sure what to do with that.
Yeah.
I need to know specifically what she means by sexed body.
Right.
But that sounds like she's describing gender.
Yeah.
Again, the way that it's typically conceptualized.
Is gender just a human thing?
And that was what I wanted to push on. Yeah.
So because, I wish you could see their expression just now. It was pretty animated.
Because that's what I felt, at least how Cook is representing Roughgarden, is that Roughgarden saying, oh, all these different approaches to doing your thing, whatever that is, as an animal. And so she brings up cases where you have, like, and we've maybe talked about them in here before, like, so, again, where the language comes in, there's a type of approach for males in some cases that we call garter versus sneaker males. Those are both sperm producing, but they have really different behaviors. And Roughgarden, exactly. And Roughgarden seems to want to take those strategies and call those genders. And that's, I feel uncomfortable with that because I feel like gender really is a human concept. And this is where we get loose as biologists often, I think, with our language, is that we will co-opt something from just general parlance that I think comes with a lot of baggage. And that's where I'm like, I wish we could come up with something else. And I understand the difficulty of having, coming up with more jargon, clearly, and having it be accepted. But what do you think, Mark? Because you teach human sexuality.
Right. Well, and the thing is, in my human sexuality class, I don't really talk about non-human animals because it is human sexuality. I do a little bit at the beginning just to introduce sort of kind of overarching theoretical approaches, and you absolutely have to talk about sexual selection and because it informs evolutionary psychology and stuff like that. But it's really just like, oh, here's a way of thinking about things, and we can maybe kind of revisit this stuff. But
how do you feel about applying the term gender to a non-human organism?
See, that's where I start to.
He's very expressive, guys.
No, I start to struggle a little bit because in one sense, you want to be able to. But then, I think of the degree to which it's tied, or at least as psychologists think of it, to identity.
Your perception of whom you are.
And self-concept. Yeah. And then you got to ask, do clownfish have a self-concept, right? Or are they just engaging in behaviors that fit their circumstances?
Right. The way I think about it is think about a male seahorse. Right. So this male seahorse has a pouch, as you might remember. They're the kind of fish that the male takes all the eggs and broods them in its own brood pouch. And so here you are, a male seahorse with your pouch full.
Looking pregnant.
Very looking pregnant. You are pregnant. You're taking care of these eggs and you're helping them grow and develop, and you're being so masculine.
Right.
That's such a male thing to do. Or an ostrich. Ostrich sits on his nest of eggs that of all the females he's sort of courted to have lay the eggs on those nests. And he is the one that actually incubates them and takes care of them and raises the young.
Right.
This idea of, I think earlier, Mark, previous episodes, you talked about the sort of spectrum of male, masculine to feminine, and somebody falls in between those two sort of endpoints. But then like you're saying, Sarah, when you talk about animals, is that a masculine seahorse? Well,
and here's another thing that just occurred to me, is that you're not going to find among the clownfish or any other animal species, an organism that starts engaging in a series of behaviors that we might consider inconsistent with their biological sex, and then the others in that community going, hey, what are you doing?
That's weird.
Yeah. That's wrong. Yeah. Now you're making me uncomfortable.
Right.
But that's what we see with humans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's one of the things I wrote to myself here is that humans are slowly and with great resistance coming to the conclusion that sex is not assigned by gonads, but by the brain. Right. And I think...
And I got to qualify, maybe I'm jumping ahead, because like one of the very last notes that I wrote, where she says she's optimistic about the scientific community coming to a better understanding, mm-hmm. a more realistic kind of embracing of this new notion of this. And my concern is, okay, let's be optimistic and say that, yes, the scientific community is going to do that. I'm not so optimistic about the non-scientific community. You know what I'm saying? So, mm-hmm. so like in terms of our public, you know, again, in the context of all that's going on in our politics right now, I don't know that the rest of us embrace those ideas.
Well, I mean, I don't know if you can stop it, right? I mean, we all work in a college, right?
Yeah.
So we all deal with these very specific age categories mm-hmm. of people,
right.
18 to 21, 22 mm-hmm. year olds. And in the many years I've been here, right, the last 4 years, 5 years have been quite different.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And it's sort of, to me, like the genie is out of the bottle, right? Mm-hmm. You're not going to change it. And I was wondering how much the current societal resistance to these challenges are similar to the civil rights movement, right?
And
how there was such resistance to accepting others as equals.
Right, right.
And I wonder how much of the way in which people sort of love that binary, that sort of, I know who you are, mm-hmm. I know you're, you know, oh my God, I'm attracted to you and you're a transgendered male, female. What does that mean about me? You know?
Yeah.
I remember when, I don't know if I told the story, but when I was an undergrad, I went to a super famous, not famous, but it was super cool gay bar in Tampa, in Ybor City, that was a whole city block. And there were 7 different bars. Yeah. It was like a country western bar.
Yeah.
There was they had all these different kind of bars, but mm-hmm. one of them was they had the show bar where you could go and watch them come in and do their shows. And I fell in love with this Nancy Sinatra, these boots are made for walking.
Yeah, that does not surprise me at all.
And I remember sitting in this little cocktail, it's like a 1960s cocktail bar mm-hmm. where you're sitting at the table drinking your beer, and this absolutely beautiful woman's out there singing, these boots are made for walking, and my brain's going, what? Because that is hot. But, it didn't bother me. I mean, I know who I am, but I can see that for a lot of people today, that freaks them out,
yeah.
right? They don't know what the rules are. Or I think interestingly, and I think maybe it may be beyond this podcast, but I'm going to go there, is they want to subjugate women. And if you have somebody who used to be, in their mind, mm-hmm. a man, how do they parse that? I wonder how much that drives their uncomfortableness with the fluidity of identity that we mm-hmm. see now. I'm not sure.
Yeah. I mean, I think especially when within athletics, right, there's such a, right, because it's especially for people who transition from male to female, that there's this, you can't do that, that's unfair,
right,
kind of stuff, even though we know. Start dosing with estrogen, it changes significantly what the body does. But I get what you're saying. I think, though, I mean, clearly, yeah, we had the civil rights movement, but we have super bad race relations in this country still.
So, right.
So I think, better. I know, but I guess that's what I'm just like, I'm kind of with you, Mark, in that I don't think it's going to just, because scientists start being okay with it, it's going to change things. I do agree with you, James, in that this new generation, Gen Z kids, are thinking about it completely differently. But even within their generation, and I know we have students here that are very uncomfortable with it, right? Mm-hmm. I can imagine how evolutionarily it made a lot of sense that you should be able to classify somebody very quickly, right, into your male, your female, because I have to decide if you're a good potential mm-hmm. mate, right? And so I can also see how there would be an evolutionary advantage to saying you're that.
Yeah, having clear identities.
Yeah.
So one of the things that Lucy Cook made in the argument in this chapter, I thought, was about, and I was going to ask you, Mark, your thoughts on this idea that we are blinded by our culture and how, or not blinded, we're sort of, the lens in which we see the way these organisms act sort of shapes the way we treat them. Like one of the things that I thought was shocking is she makes the argument that lab mice, mm-hmm. for example, have been bred to have females less aggressive than they would be naturally in the wild, because we have this sort of patriarchal view that the females have to be submissive and caretakers, and the males have to be the dominant ones. Mm-hmm. And so our lab mice have now been shaped by our own societal views of the roles males and females play.
Sure.
So I was wondering, you know, could you elaborate on that? Or what's your thoughts as a psychologist about how, or like even you as a psychologist, how do you try to wrestle with the idea that my own vision, my own interpretations of what's going on are influenced by where I'm coming from?
Well, of course. And that fits with our whole understanding of how biases work, is that you're unaware that you have them, right? You can see them in others. Right, I can point out you're engaging in confirmation bias. Right? You're cherry picking information to support you, but we don't really necessarily always see it in ourselves, unless we take the effort. That's the thing, is that you've got to be motivated and you've got to be able to actually sort of critically evaluate your own perspective. You know, these are not quick decisions that are made in terms of like how we breed these mice. Right, in the process of breeding these mice, you've got these females that don't seem to be quite so passive as you would expect. So those get culled, right? And to perpetuate the other. But you're not necessarily aware of it's my understanding of gender that may be questioned, right? That's driving my decision.
I tolerate males being aggressive, but I don't tolerate females being aggressive.
And that when they are, it's an aberration. It's an exception. And so we want these to be representative. Right. Of course, your understanding of your representation is informed by, again, these kind of hidden expectations or enculturated expectations. Yeah. You're not aware of where they come from.
Yeah, because it's just as women who, when they were involved in this research, were also doing this, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, it's not, I mean, I would argue that our very white and very male domination of science until very recently plays a role in this, clearly, and that if you have more diverse voices in the room, those biases become slightly less easy to enforce, right? Because somebody can question you, even if they're often in a position not of power. And so we have all those problems,
too. Or themselves influenced by culture. And they don't even see their own biases, right? Like the classic studies with taking names off of people who apply for jobs in the sciences.
Yeah.
And both men and women researchers showed the same bias. All right. So we've got this notion that she's talking about beyond the binary. And I think, as I said, this chapter is short, but I thought does a very nice job of trying to get you to realize that the sort of simple binary doesn't make sense. And I also want to just circle back. Did we conclude that gender is just a human construct that doesn't fit with animal world?
I don't think we concluded anything, James.
I disagree, because I think that's what I heard from you, Mark, even though you don't want to agree to it. But I mean, because it is...
So my contention, again, just to kind of go back, is that if we suggest that gender is tied to a sense of identity. Self and identity, then I think we need to restrict it to humans. But if we're describing gender as patterns of behavior, then we see it with clownfish.
But then that seems to, I mean, I would say the argument of this chapter is those patterns of behavior are sex, right? Like, and that's, so that's not even gender then anymore. Right.
So maybe they're one in the same.
I don't know. I don't know. This is, I have to say, like, for part of me, I, again, struggle a little bit in thinking, I guess because of how much bias has existed in society against anybody that's not a white man. that when you start saying that sex is in the brain, then I just think of all the stuff where, like, oh, women are they're just not good at math because their brains are different. And I start thinking about all these things of how people can use, which, again, that's not how you do science. But I have to admit, like, just as a kind of gut response, I feel weird about it, thinking of sex as being the way your brain is made.
But even still, I would say that those things are perceptions. One of the things that she points out, in terms of these other features, is that there's much more variation within sex than there is between sex. And we see this across psychological factors as well. Yeah. So math ability, language ability, intelligence, all these sorts of things, there's way more variation within sexes than there is between sexes. And so we do tend to focus on
the mean.
These means, right? That may differ, but that's not really sort of clearly portraying the picture of what the reality is like.
Right. And those the problem with those means are depends on what culture you're grown up in, right? If you're in a grown if you're a female growing up in a culture that dissuades you from doing math, mm-hmm. it's not surprising that right. females don't do well in math. Yeah. If you're in a culture that encourages women to do math or X, Y, Z, mm-hmm. Right. other kinds of characteristics that we talk about.
Yeah.
Yeah. You see that, that they write, you know, right. both genders, both sexes. Now I'm confusing myself.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So that, and she does a nice job pointing out, hey, we all start off with the same brain, right? Mm-hmm. It's really the same brain. And why you would think one brain has the capability to do something much better than the other brain doesn't make any sense when we start off with the same brain.
Yeah. So again, it's not nature or nurture. It's right. nature slash nurture. I mean, right. it's kind of all of
hormones
it.
Too.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, the other thing, like, to me, there was, like, there's these three axes, actually, that were happening in this chapter. And so there's sex, whatever mm-hmm. the hell that means.
What is that, like, physical?
Gender.
Sex is the sex, XY chromosomes. The, what gonads?
Gonads, yeah,
what,
right? What kind
what
of gametes?
Gametes?
Yeah.
Right.
So gametes that you make, gender, which mm-hmm. is still, like, vague to me, and then sexual behavior, which in that you could, you know, again, that could be bring in these ideas of, you know, same-sex behavior, heterosexual behavior, right? So sexual behavior is not just like my patterns of behavior. It's like these females getting aggressive, but also with whom do I engage in sexual
interactions?
Yeah,
with.
Right. And especially because when we think about humans, right, all those things are different. Right? What kind of gametes you make, who you're attracted to,
right.
and how you identify.
Yeah, oh, sure.
Yeah, and how do we fit it into
as,
this?
As well as that whole other palette
right.
of behaviors,
yeah,
right? In
exactly.
terms of, you know, engage things that we that culturally are defined as
right,
feminine patterns
yeah.
or masculine patterns.
Right.
So there's your fourth axis.
Right,
yeah.
Yes, exactly. And so I'm struggling biologically with what I think about gender still. Because I kind of like the idea that where you could, like, you know, you have, so for like the blue-headed wrasse that we didn't talk about, but you have individuals that are born male, who are born female, and that transition from male to female,
mm-hmm.
right? So you have these three different kinds of, what do we want to call them? Are those sexes? Are those genders? Because is the female who was always a female different from the male who became a female, right? They do have different behaviors. Mm-hmm. And so that's where I'm still just kind of, in my own brain, struggling a little bit about what I think about. I still like this idea of having something, because I guess I'm still like categories as a human, right? And that I could be like, but maybe it's not just male, female, and there's like category A, B, C, D, and right. F in this certain organism, right?
Well, I say over and over again in my social psychology class is that humans are categorizers.
Yeah.
We need to, right? Because we have an understanding. I didn't mean to place my emphasis on the we, right? Because maybe other organisms do,
yeah.
but
we understand right. ourselves.
We have right. we have two hemispheres,
yes,
and we like to have binary
exactly.
categories: male, female, yeah. right, wrong.
Because it makes the world easy,
yes,
right, and convenient.
If you only have to classify into two
right.
categories versus five, it's
right.
a lot easier.
And you don't have to put that effort, the cognitive effort,
yeah,
into
exactly.
subtle
figuring
distinctions
out
or areas of gray, right.
Yeah.
Black and white makes it easy for us.
Yeah. I think, you know, going along with what you're saying, Sarah, I think as the problem I have going also with Mark, the idea that our cultural lens sort of influences how we interpret things. The word aggression has been used a couple of times mm-hmm. just now. And it's really hard for me to put aggression in the category of a female behavior, right? Because of just my culture.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I know I can talk about female praying mantises. I can
mm-hmm.
think about many examples in which females are super aggressive. Hyenas, mm-hmm. we've talked about. But yet, mm-hmm. it is really hard for my brain. You know, if we were doing that, those tests where you,
yeah.
like, you connect two words and then you have to decide
the
if it
INT,
fits or not.
Yeah.
Yes.
Implicit association test.
Implicit,
yeah.
yes.
Yeah.
Association. If you're familiar, you just basically hit keys whether you think these two words are connected or not. And aggression in female is definitely would never be connected in my brain, mm-hmm. even though, you know, I'm familiar with many,
right,
many
right,
examples.
Yeah, exactly.
And so it's really hard for us, like going back to your idea of what's a female role, maybe that's the problem because we assume there's a stereotypical female role and that's where we get ourselves in a trap because being aggressive female is a very
mm-hmm.
adaptive behavior
mm-hmm.
in many circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
And being a passive, supportive, you know, nurturing male, mm-hmm. which we think is a female trait in our worldview, is totally adaptive as a male strategy. Mm-hmm. And so it's real, you know, that's what I'm struggling with here. Because,
well, and I think because, again, the strategies themselves don't have to be binary.
Right.
Right. And and I think that's what, you know, again, the whole book has done, but this chapter as well, in terms of just thinking about, there's just, it's really hard to put things in two buckets, actually.
Yeah. But it's so easy.
I know.
Yes.
So nice. So much easier for us.
takes less effort.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, Mark and Sarah are going to tell us how Darwin would think about sexual selection in this new world that we have.
Wait, let me open up Chat GPT.
Yeah. All right, you're listening to Discovering Darwin. She walked up to me and she asked me to dance. I asked her her name and in a dark brown voice she said hello.
Welcome back. You're listening to Discovering Darwin, and we are in our last episode covering Bitch by Lucy Cook. And we are now going to focus on the conclusion, which is really getting us to think about where have we been, where are we going? And more importantly, Mark, keep typing. What would Darwin say today about all this new things we know about sexual selection? Is he excited?
I think Sarah wants Mark to fire up his Chat GPT 4.0 and see. But I had sprung on them, as Sarah points out. I like to do this idea, if Darwin was today and we like fed him all this information about, you know, the idea of how sex is determined and whether or not we agree that gender exists outside of humans, mm-hmm. but let's just say sexual roles, like how would he reinvent sexual selection? Because historically, right, let's remind ourselves the model by mm-hmm. which Darwin, right? It's aggressive males competing against other aggressive males to coy females who don't want to get mated unless they're convinced that this is mm-hmm. the right male. And the male will convince the females through their vigorous displays or their ornate secondary sexual characteristics, these investments that they make, and they say, look at me, look at me, look at me, this is me. And then the female says, okay, you're the one.
Which, of course, my favorite Darwin quote, which I'm paraphrasing now, but the female chooses not the most enticing male, but the one that is least distasteful. So it's not even that she's like excited about it. She's like, okay.
You're the best of the worst.
Yes. Yeah.
But the criticisms, as Lucy Cook points out beautifully in the final conclusion, is the criticism is that females become this passive role. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The males are the active role. Females are just reacting to what the males are doing, and the females really don't contribute to the story, right? To the sexual selection story. And I was wondering, now that we sort of realize that these roles are not binary and these roles are not so, single role, there's aggressive females, there's all these other kinds of behaviors that we tend to stick into, you know, masculine, feminine categories, which is unfair, but we do that. How would Darwin then, like, develop a sexual selection theory?
So I have two thoughts.
Okay.
In my bourbon-addled brain. one is, he was already, as we've just discussed, self-censoring, it seems like. He didn't bring in barnacles.
He knew about barnacles.
Fit in these categories.
Yeah.
And I still think you take the Victorian man out of Victorian England and plop him down in 21st century.
So you're saying you can take the Victorian, you can take the man out of the Victorian, but you can't
because
take the Victorian
out of the man. Yes. So I'm not sure that, because he clearly had contrary evidence to his.
But let's just say he becomes woke, as they say, right?
Oh, okay. So then it's really not Darwin anymore.
Good point. Mm-hmm. Well point. Okay, so then some people have attempted to try to modernize sexual mm-hmm. selection. We talked about Joan Roughgarden, mm-hmm. and we haven't actually really explored much about what her position is. But let's just ask you guys, what do you guys think it should be? What would a modern sexual selection model be? It's clear that it wouldn't focus just on physical traits, right? Mm-hmm. And
right.
It wouldn't just focus on males.
Right.
But then what would it expand to? What do you guys think?
I mean, I think for one that we, like, and these were some papers that Cook cited, and just in me in thinking about these things, is that like we've also just ignored females from the equation, so we haven't even studied them. So I think that's one thing, right, is actually studying females. I think it's also not getting too tied up, and we'll talk about this more, I think, but not getting too tied up in what the systems are that we have been using to study sexual selection, that our choice of systems, we already talked about with mice, right, that we've selected for docile females have set up so that we collect only certain kinds of data, right?
So you're saying we should broaden the model systems and then try to cast aside the stereotypical views of what male and female should be doing.
Yeah.
Right. What do you think, Mark?
Well, and of course, I'm coming from the perspective of a psychologist. I'm focusing on humans. Mm-hmm. And I think as difficult as it is, we've got to sort of get beyond the notion of categorization, and not just in terms of male female, but even, you know, male female transgender, you know, what as she points out, you know, recognizing that what we're talking about, I think both in terms of sex and if we want to make this distinction in terms of gender, are continuum. Is a continuum, right? Mm-hmm. It's not, there's no discrete point along this spectrum that puts you, any individual, into one situation or another situation. That being said, and again, it's difficult to disentangle culture and, you know, biology and actual experiences. For the most part, right, most things do line up in that cis kind of typical way, right? That, but again, it's difficult to disentangle the cultural influences in terms of our understanding of male female, right, as well as the biology, the brain stuff, the hormones, the gametes, and that sort of thing. And again, just sort of recognizing that what we're talking about is a continuum, but it's a bimodal continuum, perhaps.
Yeah.
Bimodal
continuum. Yeah, I know. Thank you, Widow Jane.
That's just made up I'm talking term. Right there.
Okay, James, what's your thought?
Yeah.
Since you actually had more than 15 minutes to think about it.
Yeah, 17 minutes. No, I think I've come to sort of realize that the Darwinian view of mostly focusing on physical traits and mostly focusing on the male obviously is short-sighted. I think Darwin today would understand there's a lot of really interesting like female cooperation, female-female cooperation in dealing with the whole game of reproduction, and looking at what females are looking for in other females, and also that a lot of these displays that we look at, we typically say, oh, that's a display, so the male is indicating his fitness, his health, his, you know. But, you know, there's a lot of ways to indicate your ability to help rear the young, like as a parent. Like what kind of resources are you going to bring to the offspring? Not so much how aggressive are you or whatever. So I think there's other kinds of characteristics that might be viewed as being valuable versus the old sort of
just be aggressive and be a good chooser.
Right. Yeah. That the sort of mate choice kind of views of the other roles you can have as a, particularly in organisms like birds where there's a lot of male and females rear the young, right? Mm-hmm. There's equal investment in the offspring. So looking at them only as a source of sperm seems short-sighted.
You know, it's interesting because I'm teaching evolution this semester, and so I do feel like I have thought about how I'm teaching sexual selection differently, and yet I only have a week to cover it. And so
But you made the syllabus.
I know. Here's the funny... Okay, so here's another interesting thing. I don't know if it's just the combination of students I have or if it's truly a Gen Z thing, is that I actually have like left the last 3 weeks for them to decide what they want to talk about.
Nice.
And so I put out a Google survey as a place to try to start generating what the heck they were interested in. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I said was like, hey, let's talk about more about sexual selection because I feel like I haven't been able to give it I've given it short shrift in terms of its diversity and complexity at the bottom of the list.
Mm.
It's like in the, you know, I had like 7 things and it was like number 5.
Wow.
Yeah.
What was the number 1?
Origin of Life, which I'm kicking myself that I put it on there because it's not really evolution.
Yeah, come on.
You gotta have life or you have evolution.
Right? Exactly. So that, I'm like, oh, why'd I do that? I don't know that much about this. So anyway, but I, you know, I have been thinking about it a lot more. And so I do feel like I'm trying to like embroider in some nuance as I go along. But yet when you are... I'm trying to give you some information in a relatively short amount of time. I can't do the diversity, right? It's so much easier to teach it in this simple way. And I don't do it as like, this is male or female, but I do like when mates are limiting, what right. are strategies when,
right.
when, you know, your reproductive output is limiting, but even that, and I'm trying to pull more of these things in, like, look at all these extra pair copulations. Females are not coy. Right. Look at all the, you know, these places where males are choosing their mates. Males are, you know, males are also discriminating. Males are also limited by the number of sperm they can make. So I'm pulling these things in, but I just think about it and I'm like, oh, I could do this so much better. And I'm like, I want to teach a May term just on sexual selection.
I was about to say, let's sounds like a perfect May term class. And it may be that they're not at the stage yet where they can appreciate the complexities and the nuances of this.
Yeah.
Right. So for them, where life comes from, that's a bigger question.
Right. Yeah. 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 And I think, you know, as I said, I brought this book in because I used it in my capstone class and they loved it, you know, and it went really well there. And I thought it was a great thing for a capstone class because it did challenge maybe some of their perceptions where they didn't have enough time to think about things. Anyway, that is to say, I can still understand why the kind of basic, you know, Darwin to Bateman to Trivers kind of story is out there because it's an easier story to tell to undergraduates, you know, and even, you know, the textbook I use, which I think is a pretty good one and that it, you know, it's pretty up to date and, you know, it's a good story. Actually, Carl Zimmer is one of the writers. And so it's a scientist and Carl Zimmer. Yeah, this chapter on sexual selection is really
pretty
not
standard.
That, yeah.
Pretty standard.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sounds like you need to write your own book.
Lucy did it for me.
So I'm going to pivot now and talk about what do we think science should do from now on, right? Okay, so we got this next generation of scientists coming along. And Lucy Cook makes the really nice argument. This conclusion is entitled, actually, A Natural World Without Prejudice, right? And I think one of the unseen prejudice that she talks about earlier was that whole mice story. Like the white mice of labs have been bred by us to have certain behaviors because that's what we like. And now we're like looking at them as a model system, right? And I think, Sarah, earlier you kind of criticized some model system. Can you expand on that sort of criticism?
Yeah, so... And maybe we even should take a step back and talk about what a model system is and why we have them. And so, again, I think as listeners, you have to at least be science curious to still be with us, right? And so you probably have a little bit of an idea of this, but we're looking at model systems that we hope are tractable enough for us to be able to really be confident about the conclusions that we're making, but then we want to apply them more broadly, right? And most of those model systems were developed with a genetic or biomedical perspective of what we wanted to do with them. So, you know, mice and monkeys and
fruit
flies, right? And for plants, like this little thing, Arabidopsis, you might have heard of. And so all of these...
I haven't heard of that.
No. Okay, because it's a plant. Nobody cares. except me. but, you know, within all of these, we need to have, you know, enough context and background in the system. We need to... Obviously, you have to kind of reduce variability so you know what you're doing. You want to know the genetic...
That's why we only look at males, not females.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly.
Because males
cycling hormones are really problematic. And so a lot of the things that probably are useful in genetic or biomedical model systems are actually really problematic in a evolution or ecology system, because it's, for us, it's all about how the variation leads to the things we see, and we are eliminating variation when we're doing these model systems.
Right.
And so, like, this paper I was looking at looked back and said, looked at, you know, what the proportion of papers are that were, you know, forced sexual selection based on model system. And it was like, I think it was in the 30% for Drosophila melanogaster, which is the fruit fly. Mm. But then at the genus level, it was over 40%. Right, is all based on this one species that we know has all these kind of unique things.
Quirks, yeah.
That was all chosen because phenologically it's useful, because you could go out in the spring and pick a bunch of them off of a fruit tree.
They don't do that.
Not anymore, but when we started it, right? But they have quick life cycles, all these kinds of things. But then they have all these weird quirks that actually fit very well into what we now perceive as what is male, what is female.
And classic bias.
Yeah, like sexual conflict and
right.
All of these kinds of ideas.
And of course, one of the things she points out too, and clearly very apparent, but these model systems are developed by a population of modelers who are predominantly male. And so her call for, as has been the call for a while, right? Yeah. So the diversification of the folks who participate in this. That can only help.
Yeah, exactly. Right?
Again, we'll struggle against perspectives that even folks who don't fit those cultural norms necessarily experience, but bringing in those different perspectives, different ways of seeing things are going to help break us out of this rut.
And the thing that, so there was a recent paper, Meg Duffy was the lead author from 2022, and that was actually calling for more new model systems in evolution, ecology, and behavior. One of the things I talked explicitly about is more diversity in representation of who's doing these things. But an interesting thing that happens in the way science is done, especially those that are working at the R ones, the like we're really producing, is you got to figure out a way to continue the work you're doing, but differentiate it from all the people who you've worked with. So from your PhD advisor, postdoc advisor. And so, you know, in some ways, and for us at little places where we don't produce a lot, we have a little more freedom, is that a lot of times we move away from the model system because it's less competitive.
Right. Oh, totally.
Right. Mm. And so, like, to me, that was an interesting thing to think of, too, of a different kind of diversity, which is the diversity of institutions involved because of the fact that we can take these kinds of risks because we're not, right? But it's the young people that have to take the risk then in making these new model systems. And, like, you could devote yourself to this model system and it doesn't pan out, right?
And so they're the ones most at risk.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So there's so many structural things about how science is done.
And if you're applying for a National Science Foundation grant,
and you're like, I'm not using zebrafish, I'm going to use betafish, right? And like, they're like, no. Like,
what? Yeah.
Yeah.
So, that's one thing that Lucy Cook really points out, is the lack of variation, and yet we've talked about this. Variation is the core of all evolution.
Right.
And we've picked systems that show very little variation as our model systems, because it's the signal-to-noise ratio is in our favor.
And if you want to make these broad generalizations about what is sexual selection, and they're all based on a single weird organism that just happened to become canalized as your model system, right? That's what leads to the kinds of things that we've done historically, right?
And she also points out, a structural problem too, the reluctance to replicate.
Yes.
Right? You know, which again is, I mean, and that's, we see this across every domain in science, right? And it leads us to these
non-replicatable
experiments. Yeah. These things that are taken as like, oh, this is the case, and it gets a lot of attention, but no one has tried to replicate it, because there's nothing productive I'm putting that in air quotes, in terms of your career and doing that. So these false ideas don't get a chance to be falsified.
You know, the last thing I kind of want to talk about is Lucy Cook, I think, what did you call them, Sarah, the women scientists, the dream team?
Yeah, the women dream team.
Right, West Eberhard, Gowaty, and Hurdy.
Yeah.
I think they don't get known out there because their names are so weird. I'm sorry. Come on. They're not like Dawkins. Really easy to say. She doesn't even have a vowel in her name. Hrdy. And Gowaty. Yeah. And West Eberhard, I guess, because she married some guy named West. Because her last name's Eberhard. I think she married a guy named West.
Well, and Hurdy was... That's not her
name. Oh, really? That's not her name? Yeah. Oh, I didn't know
that. Because, like, she puts her middle... her. But anyway,
I was being frivolous there with the names. But I thought it was interesting because Lucy Cook does a great job pointing out that these are very famous, brilliant scientists who've added a lot to our understanding of sexual selection theory and of just animal behavior and the natural world. And yet, most people don't know them.
Right.
And I went back to my most recent animal behavior text that I'm using. I'm not going to point out the name of the author, but that person should look at their own book. Because I went through all the, it's also a stupid way they do their references is by chapter. So I had to go through every chapter.
And
look. But nonetheless, West Eberhardt was quoted, cited three times in the whole text. Gawati is, am I saying it right? Gawati?
Oh, I always thought it was Gowdy.
Gowdy. Yeah. Okay, sorry. Two times. And Hurdy once. And I think her citation, I would not agree with the way it was represented because it was mostly about the male aggression on infanticide and ignored female behaviors at all. But nonetheless, she got referenced there. So that was six references in the whole animal behavior textbook. Dawkins was cited 10 times.
He's not even a behavioral ecologist.
Really. I know, but 10 times, that more than all those women combined. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think her point is well taken. And, you know, how do we get these authors and their contributions out there and become part of the canon? Because they're definitely, as you read this book, you realize they really do open up our views of how things work.
Well, I mean, the other thing that strikes me is that these are all women at the end of their careers.
Yeah.
You know, so who's the next, you know, group? And I think, you know, Patricia Brennan, we talked about, she's the one, Patricia Brennan, who did the work on vaginas, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she's the one that got the recent paper about snakes having two clitori. Like, maybe she's somebody that would be there. But, you know, she's at Mount Holyoke, which is a really good liberal arts college.
Right.
But it's a liberal arts college.
Right.
And so she can't, like, you know, do the way these big labs do. And so that, I guess that really got me thinking about this, and that she has these kind of superstar, awesome women, but they're at the end of their careers. And who's the next wave?
And that's very depressing to think that they're at the end of their careers and yet they're still not being cited and or identified.
Well, and part of me was thinking, like, okay, so I'm pretty sure Gowdy is married to Stephen Hubble, who's like super famous for, he's a tropical ecologist. And so he's the one that has the 58 hectare plot on BCI and this big neutral theory model and all this stuff. And then West Eberhardt is also married to Eberhardt, who also was on BCI. And that, like, so their husbands are more famous than they are. And, but, you know, they're doing, to me, in some ways, much more, and maybe that's it. Like, it's probably because they are much more, I'm sorry, Joan Roughgarden, but they are more iconoclastic than you are and claim to be. and so because of that, they're not, right? They're not brought into the fold and cited the same way.
So maybe as much as it pains me to say it, because I do have a great idea for what the next season should be about.
Oh, that's good.
William James. But so maybe our role might be
to elevate.
We choose one of them for the next season.
A new?
Yeah. Let's take.
Oh, one of these three women?
Yes.
Maybe? Oh, okay.
That's our focus.
Maybe.
No. They're pointing out that I'm like, well, we're pretty much done. I don't know what I'm going to do next.
Yeah.
William James.
All right. So I think we're, I have, we, yeah, I think, I just saw a quote that I underlined, Sarah, about her, Lucy Cook's, I have to say, dear listener, you know, you've heard us talk about this book. It is so beautifully written.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And she has such great lines, but she wrote about model systems. Their use is often trapped by history and convenience rather than relevance.
Yeah.
Just such great little points.
Yeah.
I wish you had looked at Marlene Zook in your, because I think she would be our other dream team. But she's also kind of the same point in her career as these other women are.
Who's Marlene Zook?
So she is also a evolutionary biologist who has been someone who has very much tried to forward. In fact, one of the reviews I was reading about how we need to rethink our model system was hers.
Yeah.
Is that she has really thought about that, and she has also.
Yeah, I bring up an animal behavior, so I'm familiar with that name. I didn't look her up, though. I should have.
Yeah.
All right, dear listener, I hope this
rambling conversation was at least entertaining to you as you cleaned your dishes and vacuumed your house.
Also, listeners, because we do hope to interview Lucy Cook, if you have questions, burning questions, gosh, you want to ask her, please send them to us. You can private message through our Facebook page or through our Instagram page, or I bet you could find our email addresses out there on Transyland.
But if you go to discoveringdarwin.blogspot.com.
Oh, leave a comment there.
Yeah, we have a totally place where you can leave
let
a
us,
comment.
Yeah, let us know, especially if you've read the text or just after having heard us slaughter the text for the last season, that you're like, please set these jokers right by asking Lucy Cook the following.
Maybe we've slaughtered it, but I think we've honored it at the same time.
Yes.
So
yes.
We've slaughtered it.
And thank you, dear listener, for sticking with us. Until next time, goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Mark still doesn't have a sign off.
No. I'm a little lit right now.
Like, you're asking me to have a sign off way too late in this process. Yeah.
Your boy's turnt.
Alrighty.